This lecture, Everyone's Stake in Capitalism, Roman numeral 2, was delivered in the fall of 1988 at the Jefferson School's seminars in Los Angeles and New York City. In following this lecture, it is important to have available the lecture supplement named Everyone's Stake in Capitalism, Roman numeral 2. If you are listening to this lecture as part of my full program, the supplement can be found on the CD labeled Lecture Supplements. If you did not purchase the full program, the supplement should have been sent to you either on a disk or as an email attachment file. The diagrams in the supplement can also be found on pages 624 and 625 of my book, Capitalism, in Chapter 14. First, let me please urge you to have the handout in front of you that was on your table. It'll be very helpful in following along with what I have to say, especially those two intimidating figures, which look more difficult than they actually are. Now, in the little gray box on page one, and I assume I'm being heard now, am I not? Okay. In the little gray box on the top of page one of the handout, I tell you what I'm going to tell you. The continuing theme that I'm following from the previous lecture, Everyone's Stake in Capitalism, is that capitalism exists in the material self-interest of everyone, not just the capitalists. Today, the more specific proposition I'm going to try to show is why the self-interest of the average wage earner lies with a radical reduction in government spending and in the taxation and regulation of businessmen. Now, there is a perspective from which you might say it is now obvious, self-evident, that capitalism serves the material self-interests of everyone. All you have to do is look around in the world, compare West Germany with East Germany, Taiwan with communist China, South Korea with North Korea, what could be more obvious? In a sense, that is very obvious. Nevertheless, it is vital to show at a theoretical, conceptual level why capitalism operates in the self-interest of everyone. So long as that aspect is not understood, the consequence of merely physically observing the superiority of capitalism can actually be to destroy people's confidence in rationality. Because if you consider what are the theoretical ideas that today's intellectuals hold, they have no conceptual basis for understanding how the world can be working out as it is. By everything that the Marxists know and understand, and they dominate today's intellectuals, you can be sure, by everything that they know and understand, Soviet Russia should be where Japan is, not where it is. East Germany should be pulling way ahead of West Germany, North Korea of South Korea. They have no conceptual basis for understanding why the world is turning out as it is. And a consequence is, given their conceptual understanding, they're led to the conclusion, reason doesn't work. And I think the visible failure of socialism in the world is, given the theoretical preconceptions that people have, the visible failure of socialism in the world is playing a major role in the accelerating growth of irrationality. A generation or two ago, the liberals were prepared to engineer society according to rational blueprints. Now they have so little confidence in the power of reason, they are afraid to engineer a hillside. The whole movement back to nature, health, food, whatever, this is turning away a distrust of man's mind. What's making people distrust man's mind so quickly on such a scale, I think in large measure, is the collapse of their expectations concerning rationality in the social economic realm. And this is why it is so vital to explain at a theoretical conceptual level how capitalism works why we should expect the world to be turning out as it is. Well, in the prevailing view of capitalism is the capitalists grow rich in two essential ways. They exploit the workers and they gouge the consumers. I want to briefly deal with those two notions simply by explaining the meaning of capital and the nature of its benefits to non-owners. And that will set the wider context for the specific proposition I want to demonstrate today. Now, I tell you the meaning of capital under point one, capital and its benefits to non-owners. Capital is the wealth, the means of production, owned by business enterprises. It's goods and services purchased for the purpose of producing further goods and services to be sold. For example, factories, machinery, raw materials, and semi-finished and finished goods in the hands of business firms, and the money business firms hold for the purpose of carrying on business. That is the meaning of capital. Now, if we understand the meaning, it's not too difficult to see the nature of the benefits of the existence of capital to people who don't own capital. First, capital is the source of the demand for labor. It's the capital of business firms that enables them to pay wages. The more numerous are business firms, the larger are they, the greater is the demand for labor. So the higher are people's wages by virtue of the existence of capital. A simple illustration of this would be, suppose we start off with a poor, backward country, wages are miserably low. What will turn that situation around is a massive influx of foreign investment, new capital being invested, that raises the demand for local labor, it raises wage rates. So capital is the source of the demand for labor. The wage earners don't have to own capital. They benefit from the existence of the capital owned by their employers. Capital is the source of the benefits to the buyers of products. If we look at things from a physical point of view, if we focus on the factory buildings, the machinery, and so forth of any business firm like General Motors or whatever, and we consider who physically gets the benefit of the factories, the machines, and so forth, it's the buyers of the products. You get the benefit of all of General Motors' plant and equipment simply by buying an automobile. You get the benefit of Sony's television set factories when you buy a television set. You don't have to own the capital, you don't have to be a stockholder, you get the benefit by being able to buy the product. And you have the money to buy the product because businesses are out there demanding labor and paying wages. As a matter of fact, the extent of the wealth that exists in the form of capital is so great, relative to the rest of the wealth of businessmen and capitalists, that something on the order of 90% or more of the total consumption in the economy takes place by wage and salary earners, not by businessmen and capitalists. The extent of wages and salaries paid by business firms are on the order of 10 or more times the dividends and the consumption out of interest that the owners of business have. If you just think about it, who buys most of the cars? It's not the stockholders of the auto companies or stockholders in general. It's people who earn wages and salaries. The people who are buying most of the food, the clothing, television sets, and everything else buy them out of wages and salaries. So from a physical point of view, the overwhelming beneficiary of the existence of the capital is non-owners, those who are paid wages. Now, let me quickly point out an important implication of the benefits of capital to non-owners. This is the fact that there is a benefit from the institution of inheritance to people who are not heirs. I deliberately want to say a few words about inheritance because inherited wealth is one of the prime targets of those who are ready to loot and plunder other people's wealth. In their view, the only people who can benefit from inheritance are those who are lucky enough to be heirs. If we understand the importance of capital and its benefit to non-owners, then it immediately follows that all of us benefit from the institution of inheritance, whether we personally happen to be heirs or not. Because it is possible for parents to leave wealth to children and grandparents, they are motivated to accumulate more capital and not to decumulate capital in their old age. The consequence is substantially more capital exists than would otherwise exist. The effect of that is the demand for labor is greater, the supply of goods is greater. There's a twofold benefit to non-heirs in the institution of inheritance. Now, if we put these two aspects together of capital, the demand for labor and the supply of goods, between the two of them, it becomes clear that capital is the source of real wages. Real wages represent the goods and services a wage earner is able to buy with the money he earns. It's not just the money you're paid. What counts is what you can buy with that money. Real wages always depend on a relationship between the money you earn and the prices you have to pay. If we earn double and prices are double, we're not earning any higher real wages. If we earn the same and prices were half, we'd be earning double the real wages. Well, capital, by its very nature, creates real wages. It's creating a demand for labor, it's providing the money wages, and it's providing the goods for the money wages to buy. Let me turn to the proposition I want to try to demonstrate today, that the self-interest of the average wage earner lies with a radical reduction in government spending and in the taxation and regulation of businessmen. The prevailing view, of course, is the opposite. The prevailing view is the wage earner needs government spending to give him back the loot the capitalists have allegedly plundered from him, and needs government regulation to protect him from business. Well, let's start with the fact that real wages, what the worker can buy with the money he earns, depend on the productivity of labor. What is meant by the productivity of labor is the output per unit of labor, what a person on average can produce in a year, a month, or an hour. If we have someone who's working with hand tools making shoes and he produces one pair of shoes in 2 days, that's one state of the productivity of labor. If someone else is working with power-driven machinery and produces 20 pairs of shoes in an hour, that's a radically higher state of the productivity of labor. Well, the major determinant of real wages is the productivity of labor. At one level, you can simply see the greater the productivity of labor, the more the goods there are available, the more the goods for the average person to buy. We can see it in terms of the relationship between wages and prices. The more the productivity of labor, the greater is the supply of consumers' goods relative to the supply of labor. If we have 10 people and they're each producing 10 times as much as they used to, well, now there's 10 times more goods relative to each person. And this will make the prices of goods much, much lower, but nothing has happened to reduce wages. A higher productivity of labor operates to lower prices relative to wages. And that's actually the way people's real wages rise. Normally, we think our wages rise because we make more money. That's a fallacy, the economic counterpart of thinking that it's the sun that moves around the earth. In reality, real wages go up by virtue of factors that are operating to make prices go down. We don't perceive it that way because at the same time this is happening, more money is being created, more money is spent, we earn more money, and prices don't go down as much. What makes us earn more money from year to year is the fact there is more money. We could easily earn $1 million a year each, but the same thing that enabled us to earn $1 million a year each would comparably increase the price of everything we bought. The only thing that allows us to earn more without prices rising just as much is if the productivity of labor goes up. That makes the rise in prices less than the rise in wages. And if the quantity of money didn't go up, then prices would actually fall. All right. I hope for elaboration on the productivity of labor, I refer you to the tape series, Introduction to Macroeconomics, that I made. Now, here we are, we have real wages depend on the productivity of labor. What does the productivity of labor depend on? Well, I've given you some indication. It depends on the supply of capital goods. The example of a cobbler using a hammer and a knife versus someone in a modern shoe factory using all kinds of modern equipment. Compare someone using a shovel with someone using a steam shovel. In one instance after another, automation, robotics, these represent increases in the productivity of labor. So real wages depend on the productivity of labor. The productivity of labor depends on the supply of capital goods. And now the central question becomes, what does the supply of capital goods depend on? And I'd like you to try to just read under Roman numeral 2, points 3, 4, and 5. Don't expect to really understand that. This is just a first pass, and we'll try to get into it in a moment. Just take a minute to read points 3, 4, and 5. When we've established those points, it'll be obvious why the reduction in government spending and the taxation and regulation of businessmen is to the self-interest of the average wage earner. All right, well, now I need you to turn to this terrifying figure one. What am I trying to show here? Well, production takes place by means of workers using machines on materials, in essence. Workers are working with capital goods to produce products. And here we are, we start off in year one. We want to trace things out. We want to trace out what happens over time. So we begin in year one. And in year one, there is so much labor that people are capable of performing. I arbitrarily designate that as 1L. It's some amount. Everything must exist in some quantity. In economics, we want to specify what is the quantity. So there's 1L of labor. And it works with 1K of capital goods. And between 1K of capital goods and 1L of labor, so much can be produced. Now, I'm assuming that it's possible to produce 2 units of wealth for every 1 unit of capital we have. Notice we produce 1K of capital goods and 1C of consumer goods. So there's 2 units of wealth altogether. I'm assuming with 1K of labor, of 1L of labor and 1K of capital goods, we can produce 2 units of wealth. Conceivably, we could produce 2K of capital goods and no units of consumer goods if we did nothing but produce capital goods. Or we could produce 2C of consumer goods and no capital goods. So I'm making an assumption 2 is a simple, the simplest number to work with. So I'm assuming that for each unit we have of capital goods, we're capable of producing 2 units of wealth. And I'm assuming that in this year of production, whatever capital goods exist at the beginning of the year are physically used up during that year. Flour is used up to make bread. Machinery wears out. I'm assuming, to make the analysis a little bit simpler than it would otherwise be, that all the machinery, all the buildings, everything wears out in this 1 year, and everything needs to be replaced. What's the source of replacement? Well, it's production. We have to produce capital goods sufficient to take the place of the capital goods being used up. Here we are. We start. We've got 1K of capital goods. We have so much labor using them, and we can produce so much. Now, if it happens in these circumstances that we devote half of our labor and capital goods to producing capital goods, well then at the start of year two, we'll once again have 1K of capital goods. We'll be able to produce 1C of consumer goods and 1K of capital goods, starting with our initial labor and capital goods. Now, all of our existing capital goods have been used up, but we've replaced them out of production. So we began with 1K and 1L, we've produced, we now have a fresh supply of capital goods, 1K. And if we continue in year two to devote half of our effort to producing capital goods and half to producing consumer goods, the result in year three is going to be the same, and it'll be the same indefinitely. This is a stationary economic system. It's an economic system which isn't accumulating any capital, which is simply producing as much capital as it uses up. The productivity of labor stays the same. We're not getting ahead. Now, what determines the fact that in this system, half of the existing labor and capital goods are devoted to capital goods and half to consumer goods? Why is it 50-50? Why are the percentages 50%, 50% shown just over the arrows? Well, what's determining that is the demand for capital goods relative to consumer goods. If you notice in year two, I say 1K of capital goods in response to a demand for capital goods of 500. And over on the right, 1C of consumer goods in response to a demand for consumer goods of 500. If the demand for these two categories of goods is 50-50, their relative production will be 50-50. If the demand for any category of goods rises relative to another category, there will be a greater concentration on producing that category. If the demand for housing rises relative to the demand for television sets, then business concentrates more heavily on housing, and so forth. What determines the extent to which the economic system concentrates on producing capital goods relative to consumer goods is the extent of the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumer goods. In order to get more capital goods, we have to have a sufficiently high concentration on their production. There has to be a sufficiently high relative production of capital goods. And let's start to see what happens when we get such a production of capital goods. And that occurs in figure two on the facing page. Here we start off. Again, we have the same labor, the same initial supply of capital goods. But there is a difference in the demand for the products. Now we're assuming that the demand for capital goods is 600, the demand for consumer goods is only 400. What do these hundreds mean? You could think of each unit as $1 billion. You might think the demand for capital goods is 600 billion, the demand for consumers' goods is 400 billion. Now let's try to concretize how such a shift affects things. A bigger demand for capital goods relative to consumer goods will show up in the case of a company like General Motors. It'll mean there's a bigger demand for things like diesel locomotives and trucks, which GM also makes, and a smaller demand for passenger automobiles. Now, how will that affect the way GM produces? Well, GM will redeploy its existing capacity, its existing labor force, and concentrate more heavily on the production of diesel locomotives and trucks, and less heavily on the production of passenger automobiles. Looking at the construction industry, a rise in demand for capital goods, a drop in demand for consumer goods means a rise in the demand for factory construction, a fall in the demand for the construction of homes and apartment buildings. So the existing construction industry will concentrate more heavily on factory construction. Looking at machine-producing industries, a rise in demand for capital goods and fall in demand for consumer goods means that the industries producing machinery will concentrate more heavily on producing equipment for business and less heavily on producing things like home appliances. Well, I've assumed a nice, neat, convenient 60-40 change. And now, if we're going to devote 60% of our productive efforts to producing capital goods, then instead of just getting 1K of capital goods, we'll have 1.2K. Remember, if we devoted all of our effort to producing capital goods, we could produce 2K. If we devote 6/10 of our effort to producing capital goods, that's 1.2K, 60% of 2. By the same token, the production of consumers' goods goes down. The demand for consumers' goods has fallen. We devote less resources to producing consumer goods. So in year 2, we start off, we have somewhat less consumer goods. We have 0.8C of consumer goods instead of 1. And we have 1.2 of capital goods. What's happened is existing productive ability, the existing supply of labor, is concentrating more heavily on the production of capital goods. So we have more capital goods. We're now producing more capital goods than we use up. So now notice in year 2, a very important change takes place. In year 2, production can occur with 1.2K of capital goods. That's in this central box. We now have 1.2K of capital goods working with 1L of labor. And we have more means of production. The average worker is now somewhat better equipped. The productivity of labor is higher. We have 20% more capital goods, and we're going to have a 20% greater ability to produce. Now, in year 2, we've got the potential, if we produced only consumer goods, we could produce 2.4C instead of just 2, because we're working with 20% more capital. If we produced only capital goods, well, we could have 2.4K of capital goods. Well, I'm assuming that we'll continue in this 60-40 ratio. We'll produce 20% more of both. So now the product for year 3 is 1.44K of capital goods and 0.96C of consumer goods. Well, now our supply of capital goods has increased again. In year 3, we work with 1.44K of capital goods. We have a second 20% increase in the productivity of labor. In year 4, we can have 1.728 and then 1.152C of consumer goods. The point is that if we devote our existing ability to produce more heavily to producing means of further production, the effect is that in the next year, we have a greater total ability to produce. And then we have the ability to produce both still more further means of production and more consumers' goods. Now, if you look at this figure 2, relative production of capital goods in a progressing economy, this describes contemporary Japan, contemporary South Korea, and Taiwan. They have an enormous relative production of capital goods. The Japanese economy is still considerably smaller than our own. The population of Japan is only about half of our own. But the total production of capital goods in Japan today, in absolute terms, exceeds the production in the United States and is pulling ahead by an ever-growing margin. An indication of how this occurs is, in the United States, only about 5% of people's incomes are saved. In Japan, the usual figure is on the order of 25%. What that means is the Japanese are making a vastly higher demand for capital goods. When you save, the savings are used to buy capital goods. When you consume, you're buying consumer goods. The more an economy saves, the greater is the demand for capital goods, the greater will be that economy's concentration on producing capital goods. Each new year will begin with a greater productive ability than the year before. In every year for the last 30 years, because of this higher concentration on capital goods, the Japanese economy has started each new year with more capital goods than it had the year before. It has become capable of doing more. It's continued that high concentration on capital goods. And the result, it's not a 20% annual increase, but it is an 8% annual increase. Now, we are described today by figure 1 in the United States. We're not producing very much in the way of capital goods. We have a stationary economy. All right, so I hope I've made clear the significance of the relative production of capital goods and the relative demand for capital goods versus consumer goods. This is the base of a rising productivity of labor. If each year we can produce more and more capital goods, there'll be a steadily rising productivity of labor and steadily rising real wages. Now, we can see some further factors present here. I've made the assumption that output grows in proportion to capital goods. Every time we get 20% more capital goods, we have 20% greater ability to produce. Some further element is necessary for that to be present. In order for this to go on for a sustained period of time, you need technological progress. If technological progress takes place, then it is possible that every time we increase the supply of capital goods, we can increase our total overall ability to produce. If we didn't have technological progress, the process would peter out. If we had no technological progress, we'd encounter the law of diminishing returns. You increase capital 20%, the ability to produce will only go up by 10%. Then you can only increase capital by 10%, the ability to produce goes up by 5%. The process would stop. Technological progress is necessary for its continuation. There is another aspect here which is incorporates technological progress. It's a little wider. And you can think of this as the productivity of capital goods, the ratio of output to capital. I've assumed that for each unit K of capital goods, we can get 2 units of wealth. The productivity of capital, on my assumption, is 2 to 1. Now, if the productivity of capital becomes less or greater, this will have significant effects. Imagine we had a higher productivity of capital. You might work out sometime on your own at your own leisure. What would be the implications if for each unit K of capital we could get 2.1 units of product, or conversely 1.9? Well, that would affect the rate at which the economy could progress with any given concentration on capital. The amount of output we're able to get from each existing unit of capital is critical in determining our ability to progress. If you can grasp this principle, you can understand the economy of Soviet Russia. Russia has been claiming that their standard of living since 1918 is miserably low because in all of these years they've been concentrating on heavy industry. In terms of our diagram, that would mean they would have a very, very high proportionate production of capital goods. You should expect that means each year they have a greater ability to produce, more capital goods the next year, more consumer goods too. Russia should have worked out like Japan, but it hasn't. Well, if we can take them at their word that they have been concentrating on the production of capital goods, the explanation of why they're not accumulating any, why when they want to build a truck factory they have to call in an Italian company to do it for them, that is because of a miserably low productivity of capital goods. A socialist economy is so inefficient that with whatever capital it starts, its ability to get output from that is so low that it cannot replace the capital it uses up. The typical state of a socialist economy like Soviet Russia is they build hydroelectric stations, but they don't provide generators. They have food growing in the fields, but there's no place to store the food. So from whatever capital they have, it is so misallocated, there's so little incentive to operate it efficiently, that in their case, for every 1K of capital they've got, their ability to produce is maybe 0.9. They have inherent capital decumulation. They would be back to feudalism now if not constantly bailed out by the Western world. All right, I hope the issue of the productivity of capital goods is clear. There are two central factors in capital accumulation. The extent to which we concentrate on their production, that depends on the demand for capital goods relative to consumer goods. That depends on the extent to which we save. And then there's the productivity of capital goods. How efficient are we in using the capital goods we've got? Now, if you can hold this much, then it's not difficult to understand how a radical reduction in government spending and in the taxation and regulation of business would bring about economic progress, a rising productivity of labor, and rising real wages. Because let's imagine that the way we get from figure one to figure two is that government spending is cut by 100. Let's imagine instead of the government taking $100 billion and using it to make transfer payments, meet its payroll, and so forth, buy goods, that $100 billion is left to business firms who use it to buy capital goods. Well, now we have a higher relative demand for capital goods. We'll have a greater concentration on their production. Instead of existing plant and equipment being used to produce consumers' goods for the recipients of transfer payments and the employees of the government, they'll produce capital goods for business. The effect is, in the next year, we've got more capital goods, a greater total ability to produce, and then on and on. All right. So reducing the taxes on business, the corporate income tax, the progressive personal income tax, the capital gains tax, and also the inheritance tax. These tax reductions mean that there is a greater demand for capital goods relative to consumer goods, a greater concentration on their production, the basis for a rising productivity of labor. Tax reductions on profits also operate to increase the productivity of capital goods. To the extent that profits are not taxed, the profit incentive is stronger. There's a greater incentive to develop and introduce new technologies which maintain or increase the productivity of capital goods. Small innovative firms can grow large much more rapidly if they don't have to pay a substantial share of their earnings to the government in taxes. That increases the competitive pressures on the already established firms. They have to adopt innovations. If the government is spending less, it's not going to have the funds to subsidize the perpetuation of inefficient methods of production. So reducing the taxes on business operates to provide a higher relative production of capital goods and at the same time a higher productivity of capital. Reducing government regulation raises the productivity of capital. Consider the antitrust laws and how they interfere with the productivity of capital. Let's imagine we have two firms, each of which is using the same kind of equipment, but perhaps only to 40% of its capacity. If these two firms merged, they could use half the amount of equipment at 80% of capacity. Well, this is a significant instance of getting more output from the same amount of capital. But if the antitrust laws prevent the merger, they're preventing the more efficient use of capital. Consider the consequence of pro-union legislation. The unions, almost without exception, do everything they can to prevent the introduction of labor-saving machinery. And they are notorious for feather-bedding and make-work practices. This limits how much can be produced with the existing means of production. It holds down the productivity of capital. All of the environmental legislation, the arbitrary legislation that stops all kinds of things from being constructed, that introduces interminable delays, cost run-ups, this is an important way in which the productivity of capital is being held down. So if this regulation were eliminated, we would have both a higher concentration on capital goods and as well a higher productivity of capital goods. And the result is more capital, a higher productivity of labor, and rising real wages. And I think that proves point six on page one. Thus, the effect of a reduction in government spending and in the taxation and regulation of businessmen is a continuing increase in the supply of capital goods, in the productivity of labor, and in real wages. The whole trick is a greater concentration on capital goods production and a higher productivity of capital goods. Let me say a few words about the current political situation. Much of the truth of what I'm saying was grasped by the Reagan administration and the so-called supply-siders early in the first term. And it was essentially in the name of this kind of knowledge. I don't think they have as much knowledge, but similar, that tax rates were sharply reduced. That was, as far as it went, that was a step in the right direction. The major failure of the Reagan administration was the fear of taking on the welfare state and achieving major reductions in government spending. They sought to cut taxes without cutting government spending. And the consequence of that was an enlargement in budget deficits. And the creation of deficits nullifies, and even more than nullifies, the beneficial effect of cutting taxes in making possible more saving. Let me try to illustrate it this way. Imagine the government cuts taxes by $100, and it's the taxes of someone who will save very heavily. Let's imagine someone who pays $100 less in taxes will now save $80 out of that $100. That's a very high rate. But if the government is continuing to spend that $100, it now has to borrow the $100. And it borrows it in competition with business. So its borrowing of $100 removes $100 that's available for business. Someone is saving a new and additional $80. There's a new and additional $80 coming in, but there's $100 being removed to finance the government's deficit. The effect is a net loss of capital of $20. So the idea of cutting the tax rates was an excellent idea, but it required cutting government spending at the same time. That was not done out of fear of taking on the welfare state. And the administration also largely abandoned the efforts at deregulation. Each year, the Federal Register, which is the book that contains all the new regulations, grows by several thousand pages. Maybe it grows by somewhat less than it did under President Carter. But deregulation would mean the total Federal Register should be shrinking, not growing more slowly. Now, the Democrats, in response to a virtual Q word, the deficits, are shedding a lot of crocodile tears over the harm caused by the deficits. This is the same party whose open slogan since Roosevelt, and whose practice still is, spend, spend, elect, elect, and which in the past always said about the national debt, don't worry about it, we owe it to ourselves. Now, its solution to the deficits is to raise taxes. And which taxes do you think they'll propose to raise? Well, precisely the taxes that will do the most to further reduce the demand for capital goods and further impair the productivity of capital. The point remains, the deficits should be reduced. Every reduction, but they must be reduced, should only be reduced by cuts in government spending. If the deficits are eliminated by a cut in government spending, then the government borrows that much less, there's that much more available for business, the demand for capital goods can go up, and everything else I've said will operate. Now, it shouldn't be necessary to take too much time to explain to this audience why the spending that should be cut is non-defense spending. It is the obligation of the government to defend the country, and you can look at it this way. What we want to defend the country against is the imposition in a more extreme form of the domestic policies of the welfare staters. So we want an army to defend us ultimately against welfare state spending super wild. Now, it may well be, given the fact that the Republicans aren't ready to reduce government spending, the Democrats are prepared to raise taxes, there's a very strong likelihood that the United States can enter a period of sustained economic decline. If that happens, it's still vital to know why it's declining and what's required to reverse it. In a sense, the analysis I presented is optimistic in that it shows it doesn't matter where you are, however low you are in the economic scale. You can begin to rise just as soon as you have a sufficient concentration on capital goods and a sufficient productivity of capital goods. Japan was in a miserable state in the early 1950s. It rose from that. We are nowhere near that state. We can certainly rise from where we are. By the same token, it doesn't matter how high you are, you can fall if you don't continue a sufficient concentration on capital goods and a sufficient productivity of capital goods. Well, there's more I would like to say, and I would really like the opportunity at some point to tie these propositions into our philosophical base. That's only a few further steps. But we are constrained for time, and I would like to finish a few minutes early if possible. So at this point, I'm going to open the question period, and I'm going to aim to close the question period at 20 after 10. So consider the floor open. This gentleman right here.
Do you consider lowering the capital gains tax to be similar to lowering the business tax?
Do I consider lowering the capital gains tax to be similar to lowering business taxes? Essentially, yes, and it's of the same importance as reducing the corporate income tax. The capital gains tax is the gain that you make in buying and selling assets. For example, if General Motors buys a factory and later sells the factory and makes a gain, that's a capital gain. In producing and selling automobiles and trucks, it makes a profit. It's equally important that both rates of tax be as low as possible or non-existent. This gentleman over here.
Yes, would you comment on the proposition that's very popular now that it doesn't matter that America produces capital goods, that we're in a world economy, and that South Korea now is standing in lieu of our own steel mills, for example, and therefore we can just produce consumer goods and consumer and let all the emerging nations be the steel mills?
All right, what would I say about the argument that it doesn't matter if we produce capital goods? If instead it's the steel industry of South Korea. Well, there is an element of truth in that where the capital goods are produced is not the essential thing. Let's take the case of Australia. Australia is producing a great deal of beef and cattle. They're not significant steel producers. But if the Australian ranchers use a large proportion of their revenues and incomes to buy the capital goods appropriate to ranching, well, then they're saving and investing. Those capital goods may physically come from outside the country. It's the same principle. The steel mills don't have to be in California. It's okay if they're in Pittsburgh. But the critical thing is that across the country, people be saving and investing heavily. And that's what we're not doing. American industry is falling behind. The additional capital investment in American industry is either the lowest or the second lowest of any major industrialized nation. And the rate of increase in the productivity of labor is the lowest or second lowest. This gentleman, Mr. Bolshover.
You've traced the source for capital good investments in savings. Can you comment on the factors that determine how much the demand, the saving rate would be, especially, for example, the uncertainty that consumers or wage earners face when they face rampant democracy or just the ability to legislate anything?
Okay, you're saying, could I trace the saving rate to the uncertainties people face in connection with what you describe as rampant democracy? All right, let me put it this way. One of the things that the savings rate depends on is the security of property. People have to have the conviction that what they do save will not be confiscated from them by the government or their neighbors. This comes down to the political nature of the country. The reason A major reason the Industrial Revolution started in Britain and the United States is because it had the greatest security of property. To carry it further, and now we could make a tie to a more fundamental philosophical proposition, given the security of property, what will determine the saving rate is such a thing as the extent to which people have the capacity to make the future real to themselves. If you have people who are operating on a high conceptual level and to whom something 20 or 30 years in the future has present reality, they will be inclined to save heavily. If people accept causality and recognize themselves as self-responsible causal agents capable of bettering their future condition, then they'll save heavily. So the acceptance of rationality and a rational metaphysics enters in. And that obviously underlies the base of science and technology and people being great entrepreneurs. Everything I've named can be tied back to a philosophical foundation and also to economic freedom. This gentleman right here. Yeah.
I believe it's the Galbraith type of argument, which is go like this. We have so much wealth in the economy that we can afford to take away, for example, it really shouldn't be, if we need that capital, we can take away the cars we buy, the cosmetics we buy, the general affluence. Could you comment on how you would answer?
All right, how would I answer the argument, if we need the capital, we can take away people's cars, cosmetics, whatever? What we need the capital for is so that people can have the cars, the cosmetics. But I am willing to volunteer the capital needed to produce those goods for Galbraith. Mr. Coates.
You just mentioned that I believe our investment rate or our savings rate is something like the second lowest in the Western world.
Yes.
And occasionally when I read the newspapers, I see statistics that say our tax rate is nowhere near the highest, and other seeming measures of capitalism in the United States is not anywhere near the bottom compared to more socialist countries. So why would our investment and savings rate be so low?
Are you saying you've read that our tax rates are not the highest? In fact, right now, the formal tax rates may be the lowest. In 1987, the maximum federal tax rate on individuals went to 28%, and on corporations went to 33%. But the announced rates are not the whole story. For example, in 1987, the corporate income tax rate was cut, I believe, from 46% to 33%. At the same time, the actual taxes paid by corporations increased by a third, because all kinds of tax deductions, tax credits, and so forth, the depreciation allowances, were changed. So even though the rates were lower, the actual tax burden was higher when you consider what happened to the amount of income subject to tax. And it's essentially the same story with regard to the personal tax. Yes, the maximum rate is lower, but I haven't met anyone yet whose taxes have fallen. I know that my wife's and my taxes sharply increased despite the lower rates, because all kinds of things that used to be exempt are no longer exempt. So it's the effective burden that counts. This gentleman over here, yeah.
Do the laws that we used to have that gave tax credits for capital goods, did that lead to misasset allocation, or was it actually beneficial as far as the increase of useful capital goods?
Well, we had laws allowing tax credits. That meant, for example, if a firm spent $1 million buying new plant and equipment, the tax law for many years allowed that firm to deduct $70,000, 7%, from whatever taxes it otherwise owed. Now, that legislation was beneficial to the extent that it provided another $70,000 of capital, but to some extent, it resulted in firms doing things somewhat differently than they would have done them. The best solution, the simplest, most straightforward solution, is simply to abolish the corporate income tax. That would be that would eliminate any problem of businessmen being led to make decisions they wouldn't make for the purpose of profiting from the tax code. Yes, this lady.
Could you comment briefly on the concept of a value-added tax and its impact on the productivity of capital?
Could I comment on the concept of a value-added tax? A value-added tax is applied at each stage of production. It's a tax on the sum of wages and profits and interest at each stage of production. And it's usually considered to be equivalent to a consumer sales tax. There's a tax that has to be paid, which is some percentage of the wages, profits, and interest earned at all stages in producing an item, like the wages, profits, and interest in an automobile plant, in the steel mill where the steel comes from to make the automobile, the iron mine, etc. Now, I haven't studied the nature or ramifications of the tax very closely, so I'd certainly hesitate to say that it's clearly better. If it is a consumer sales tax, or less bad, I should say, if in fact it's a consumer sales tax, the long-run harm done by a tax on consumption is that if the ability to have economic progress remains unimpaired, that the long-run harm of the tax on consumption can be overcome at some later point. Like if we start out and the standard of living is relatively low because there are high taxes on consumption, but it is possible to continue to have economic progress, well, then we can overcome that. But if we had the same burden of taxes of a type that prevented economic progress, then we'd be stuck permanently. Now, I don't think we have to make that choice. I think we should demand government spending cuts to the point that funds used for capital accumulation are not taxed away, nor is there such heavy taxation on consumers. But the implication is, if you're going to have this level of government spending and you don't want to destroy the ability of the economy to advance, then the victims have to be the average wage earner. You see, it's paradoxical. Here are the Democrats, the party of the people, the workers, and so on. They're the ones who advocate the spending. If they want that magnitude of spending without destroying the ability of the economy to progress, the only way it can be done is if the spending falls on consumption, is if the tax burden falls on the average consumer, the average wage earner. The Democratic Party, really, if you analyze what it's doing, it is sacrificing the average wage earner to the welfare recipient. Or they just destroy the country. Yes, the gentleman in the back.
Do you think that these measures will still be as beneficial as you imagine, even considering the fact that we're in a paper money economy as opposed to a gold standard economy?
Do I consider that cutting government spending and tax rates and deregulation will be as beneficial given the nature of the monetary system? Well, the problem with the monetary system is that it makes it very unlikely that the government will cut government spending. See, so long as the government has the power to create money, there is no firm pressure on them to cut spending. It's the same as if you and I had our own private printing press, and so we were spending each year more than we earned through our wages and salaries, and we were constantly moaning and groaning to our friends about our deficit and making New Year's resolutions, but we still had the power to print money. Well, that's the situation of Congress today. They talk about the deficits, and at the same time, they're enacting new programs of child care legislation, radically expanding Medicare. If we had a gold standard where the money they had to spend they didn't have the power to make, where you could only get gold by mining it or taxing it from the people, then each time they wanted to spend more, they'd have to say, here are additional taxes. That's what it would take. I'm sorry, you had a question. Yes.
Quite often the socialists will point to Sweden with its enormously high tax rates as a justification for that. Would you care to comment on that at all?
The socialists point to Sweden with its enormously high tax rates as a justification for their program. Well, there are many economic problems in Sweden, and to the extent that Sweden does not suffer as much as you might expect, it must be that there are substantial loopholes in the system. You see, let me try to give you an analogy. I think we have a theoretical basis for understanding what's required for economic progress and what will impair it. Now, if someone comes up and announces, well, here's a case I know of that contradicts everything you're saying. Here we have prosperity, even though there's no possibility of accumulating capital, even though there's no basis for maintaining the productivity of capital, that's an impossibility. If you do observe the prosperity, then there have to be some significant loopholes that make it possible. And one of the valuable books that would need to be written would be for someone who understands economic theory and who can speak Swedish to really figure out what are the actual facts there and reconcile the description of the facts with what has to be true conceptually. And the same thing applies to Japan. You know, if you watch television or read the press, I read a story a few years ago. Corporate executives were racing out to buy some book on samurai warriors. That was the basis of their explanation of the success of Japan. Then there was a television program recently on public television explaining that Japan is so successful because the workers get together in these little productivity groups as they did in the medieval villages, and that's what explains it. Well, you'd need the same thing. There was a good article written recently about Taiwan, South Korea, Hong Kong, and Singapore, pointing out that in the case of those countries, the taxation on the earnings from capital is very, very minimal. In many of those countries, new corporations are tax exempt for the first 5 years of their existence, and that's often extended. And in many cases, half the income is tax exempt thereafter. So they have a much lower tax burden. The gentleman in the far back.
Hi, since neither the Democrats or the Republicans seem to have the political will to cut welfare state spending, what do you see as the ultimate consequence of the huge deficits?
Since neither the Democrats nor the Republicans seem to have the will to cut government spending, what do I see as the ultimate consequence of the deficits or of an inflation to finance them? Well, I would see a very strong likelihood that the United States will enter a period of economic decline, if it hasn't already done so, where each year our ability to produce will be less than the year before because we haven't replaced the capital goods we've used up. And you can see signs of this already. You can look through the Midwest and all the abandoned towns and factories and so forth, the housing stock that's worn out. This is a manifestation of capital decumulation. The inability of the government to maintain the roads properly in many cases, that's a consequence of a lack of real revenue, or what revenue they have is being used for other sources, but it's not growing as it used to. Mr. Klein.
The economic growth in Japan is faster than that of the United States, but yet the standard of living of Americans is higher than that of the Japanese. Is that because of the past capital accumulation in the United States relative to Japan?
The economic growth of Japan is faster than the United States, but the standard of living in Japan is still lower than the United States. Both are true, and they're perfectly consistent. You see, compare Japan and the United States in 1950. And in 1950, the standard of living in the United States, let's say, was 50 times higher than in Japan. Since 1950, the United States may have improved at 1 or 2% a year, and Japan has improved at 8% a year. Well, it may not have gone on long enough for them to surpass us, but the gap is radically lower, and if the present rates continue, anyone growing more rapidly, sooner or later, absolutely overtakes and then passes by an ever-widening margin the country that was originally richer. Now, the standard of living in Japan could be made higher than it is right away. The Japanese government has some very foolish policies of its own. It thinks it's necessary that Japan be self-sufficient in producing rice. So they subsidize domestic rice growers and they produce food very inefficiently. They should throw that open to free importation. That would cut the price of an important item for them. And there are some other cases like that. Gentleman in the far rear.
Government as if it were an entity unto itself. It seems to mean that government is really the result of what we do to it, we the electorate. So it's not the solution of the spending policy of the government in our own hands, and it will continue to be a spend philosophy until we decide to elect those who do not spend.
The question is, isn't what the government does really a reflection of what the citizens want and have the power to change? In the mass, there's a large measure of truth to that. And if you look at the ideas that most people hold, well, I think far more people hold the idea that businessmen, if left free, exploit the workers, gouge the consumers, that unless they're controlled and regulated, there'll be all kinds of havoc and devastation. And so long as public opinion believes that, you have a government with this type of power. Now, you'd have to change public opinion. First, you'd have to change the opinion of the intellectuals. But you or I as individuals don't have any power over the government. Don't think for a moment that if you're being extorted in your income tax, that it's you who are choosing that fate for yourself. It's other people who have chosen it for you. Yes, Ms. Slaw.
Speaking of the education, have you observed any more receptiveness to free market ideas in the universities among professors or students?
Have I observed more receptiveness to free market ideas in universities or among students? I thought a few years ago that it was starting to look that way, merely because Milton Friedman had some popularity, and a lot of what he has to say is good, but he's a very mixed case. Now I'm not so sure, and now it seems that there are American universities which are actually being taken over by the Marxists. And there are even economic departments in the United States where they're already controlled by the Marxists and they hire just new Marxists. So, pardon me? I say it seems now there are universities that are being taken over by the Marxists, and there are even economics departments which are controlled by the Marxists. Can you hear it now? Okay. Yes.
Do you think there are any permanent or substantive gains to be made in Russia or Poland due to Gorbachev's concept of glasnost or any related concepts like that?
Do I think that there's any likelihood of real improvement in Russia or China due to new policies from people like Gorbachev or the Chinese leader? It's not impossible, but I would want to see a lot more. I've been amazed at some of the things I've read in the papers. Like Gorbachev has said they should lease farmland for 50-year terms to private individuals so that they would be the masters of the land and have an incentive. In China, they're leasing land on a shorter-term basis. Now, if they ever were going to change, this could well be the way they'd be changing. But whether or not they'll stick with it and carry it further, I don't know. It's also possible that they could be fomenting civil war and revolution. For example, there's a major nationalist problem in Russia, and there are people in Armenia and in the Baltic states who are demanding more autonomy, and this sort of thing could get out of hand as a result of having relaxed the reins. And I would think that if the communists do ease up and don't step in to crush things fairly soon, they may find that matters get beyond their control. But I'd want to wait to see it. Mr. Lewis.
Couldn't foreign investment here have a significant effect on capital goods?
Could foreign investment in the United States have a significant effect on the supply of capital goods in the United States? Yes, it could. And perhaps the major thing that has saved us from the consequences of our massive budget deficits has been major foreign investment. A major portion of the government budget deficit is financed by people living outside the country, and they also invest heavily in the American stock market and bond market, and that takes the place of American funds going to finance the deficit. So foreign investment has been very helpful, and the way that foreign investment benefits us is it gives us the financial means of importing goods from abroad. If foreigners invest $100 billion here, that allows us to buy $100 billion worth of goods from outside the country. And this is denounced as an unfavorable balance of payments. In fact, what's being called unfavorable is the net inflow of wealth from abroad, which has helped us to avoid some of the consequences of our own deficits. Mr. Hurwitz.
Dr. Eastman, in the objectivist society in the future, what method of taxation will the government use to finance its legitimate purposes?
What method will the government use to finance its legitimate purposes in the future? Well, for the best starting point of discussion, I have to refer you to something I'm sure you're already familiar with, government financing in a free society in the virtue of selfishness. You could have probably a variety of users' fees. But the essential question about taxation is a principle named early in the 19th century by David Ricardo. The essential thing is that it be low in absolute amount. And if we had a government that was reduced to its proper scale of just protecting people from aggression at home or abroad, and we weren't supporting foreign aggressors, then the size of the government's budget would be so small that whatever the tax system, it would not make that much difference. But as a matter of principle, we should look to how to make it voluntary. But as Ayn Rand said, that's the last step, not the first. Yes?
I've been hearing in my various arguments with the socialists, I've been hearing recently about this thing called the negative income tax, and it sounds so twisted to me that I can't figure out whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
The negative income tax was an idea regrettably advanced by Milton Friedman that people below a certain income level should receive income from the government. So it's a kind of welfare program. And it belongs in the same category as welfare and is subject to all the same basic objections. Yes, Mr. Lavin?
What do you think it was that allowed the Japanese and the Koreans to do things properly in terms of the relative production of capital goods?
What allowed them to do things properly in terms of the relative production of capital goods or in terms of the tax structure that they have? Well, I think it may have been some recognition of the role of saving and capital accumulation and a deliberate decision. Now, let me mention one further aspect which is significant, which I haven't mentioned up to now, and that's the question of Social Security. Social Security is an institution which is very highly destructive of capital accumulation. And in Japan, they didn't even have a Social Security system until 1959. And the one that they do have now is on a much more modest scale than ours. And Social Security undermines capital formation because people who are paying taxes into the system subjectively regard it as a means of providing for the future. They consider it part of their accumulation of wealth for the future. But the government, to describe it honestly, embezzles the funds and spends it on current operations, or it pays people who are currently receiving benefits. So there's hundreds of billions of dollars that if people had to accumulate savings privately, would have been saved and invested, but which instead the government has siphoned off into consumption. And that's a significant difference between the US and Japan. I'll have to limit myself to just one last question. Ms. Reardon.
Yes, you said that the Marxists
You're asking, is it the case that while the Marxists are becoming more entrenched, there is not an increased influence by the so-called Austrian economists? There is some. There are now a few departments of economics that teach what they call Austrian economics. But I don't think that begins to match the movement on the other side in quantity. And what's being passed off under the name of Austrian economics is not all that potent. The essential person in Austrian economics is von Mises. And I've noticed a tendency in reading some of these so-called younger Austrians, they dilute him with all manner of lesser figures. And so you could have an Austrian economics program where there's von Mises, two parts von Mises, and then there's Richard Striegel and people you never heard of. If they were teaching von Mises, then it would be important, but I don't think that that's what they're doing. this gentleman right here.
Which is worse, the level of government spending, if you had a high level of government spending without a deficit, or a low level of government spending with a deficit?
Which is worse, a high level of government spending without a deficit or a low level with a deficit? I would say the high level without. The real burden of the government is the amount of resources it draws out of the economy. Yes?
Taking your example of the primitive fishing society, could you very briefly describe a scenario in each of the two directions if they concentrate on capital goods or if they don't? Could you describe each scenario?
If you have two societies concentrating on capital goods or not, and in terms of that fishing society, if we had a society where people can catch so many fish and they simply consume them, they stay at that level. If temporarily they consume less and devote part of the labor that would have been devoted to producing fish for consumption, if they devote that to constructing a boat and net, then when they have the boat and net, they will then have the means of catching much more fish. And they could not devote all of their labor to catching fish. They could now continue to devote labor to building further means of production. Question in the far back. Yes.
Isn't the economy of countries like Japan and South Korea even more regulated than the United States? And if so, why do they have a higher savings rate and higher demand for capital goods?
Are the economies of Japan and South Korea more regulated than the United States? And if so, why would they have a greater concentration on capital goods? I think all things considered, from my knowledge, they're substantially less regulated. Their rates of taxation on capital have been substantially lower. They do not have a labor union movement the way the United States does. They don't have the antitrust impediments. They don't have the kind of obstacles to developing atomic power. All in all, there is much less government interference. and they have a much higher rate of saving. Just the last example, Japan has a vastly smaller social security system than the United States. That's an important matter in connection with capital accumulation. Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that people think they're saving, paying into social security for their old age, is diverted into current consumption. Instead of adding to capital, it doesn't. In Japan, that is not true on anywhere near the same scale. This gentleman, Mr. Terza.
Yes, I don't know what the current figures are, but say factories are operating at, say, 85% capacity. What is the importance of further capital accumulation when we're not fully employing the capital we have now?
All right. If factories are operating below capacity, what is the point of further capital accumulation? Well, capital accumulation is important from the point of view of more capital per worker. Let's imagine we had 85 workers and 100 shovels. You could say the capital is operated at 85% of capacity. Why do we need more? Well, we need steam shovels to replace the hand shovels. That would be the basic issue. Yes, this gentleman here.
If the amount of consumer goods relative to the amount of capital goods are determined by demand on the part of consumers, yeah, and consumers simply choose to demand more consumer goods, then how would capitalists be able to increase the amount of capital goods if demand is still being consumed?
Well, you see, the consumers buy consumer goods. The capitalists buy capital goods. To the extent that people decide that they want to save more and consume less, that makes possible an additional demand for capital goods. Yes, this gentleman here.
Dr. Eastman, what is the validity of the productivity statistics that we hear? And also, the claim by the Democrats that the quality of wages that people are now earning is lower. There's an indication that real wages are going down.
All right, what's the significance of the statistics on productivity of labor? I would say you can't take them as being very exact, but if a variety of different measures shows that year after year, the productivity of labor in the United States grows the least or the next to the least of any major industrialized nation, that is significant. Now, the Democrats have a claim, you say, that I think the quality of wages is lower. They make the point the good jobs have gone in the steel mills, and what's left is people are working at McDonald's. Now, there is some measure of truth in that, and the reason is, which the Democrats do not mention, is the existence of the compulsory labor unions, which make it impossible for the United States to compete in those industries. If you have labor unions that insist on a much higher level of wages here than exists abroad and prevent improvements in the productivity of labor, and in addition, you have a system of taxation coupled with inflation and deficits which prevent the accumulation of capital, then the good jobs disappear. Well, that's true. And the way to get them back is to reduce government spending, deregulate, reduce the taxes on business. Follow the opposite economic program of the Democrats, and you will achieve their goal. Mr. Patterson.
Is there a similarity between an economy investing more money in capital goods and an individual investing more time in education earlier in their life?
Is there a similarity between an economy investing more in capital goods and an individual investing more in education? There is a similarity. The individual will then equip himself to accomplish more later. He expands his productive ability. But we don't want to overdraw the similarity. I think did you already raise a question? Okay.
You speak of the productivity of labor and the fact that with capital goods, we increase the productivity of labor. What exactly is the productivity of labor? And for example, you're a ditch digger and you have your shovel and you're so productive.
Yeah.
I, the capitalist, come along, give you a steam shovel,
yeah,
to operate. Now, why should I pay you more to operate the steam shovel? You are not responsible for the increase.
I'll try to answer that. What is the productivity of labor? The productivity of labor is the output per unit of labor. The size, I understand, I will give you an answer that will satisfy you. With a hand shovel, the productivity of a certain amount of labor is a hole of a certain size. With a steam shovel, it's a much bigger hole. Now, why should the capitalist who provides the steam shovel pay more as the result? Normally, by the basic nature of the economic system, he wouldn't. There's a tendency to do so insofar as the quantity of money increases, that raises the demand for labor. If we had no increase in the quantity of money, people would tend to earn the same, and the cost of digging a hole would be much less. The prices of things, insofar as they depended on the digging of holes, would fall. Real wages would go up to all those workers who buy things that are produced with the aid of digging holes. Now, this is a point the labor unions don't understand. Insofar as the unions recognize any connection between wages and the productivity of labor, they think the workers should get a raise who have the higher productivity of labor. At the same time, they constantly oppose labor-saving improvements for fear that they'll take away jobs. Labor-saving improvements raise real wages by operating to reduce the prices of products. If we have an improvement in typesetting equipment, that works to raise the real wages, not of printers, but of everybody who buys typeset materials. And the labor unions operate to oppose these things. Ironically, they are a leading anti-labor institution. They're working actively against the rise in the productivity of labor, which would operate to lower prices and raise real wages. This gentleman over here.
There are very many advances in technology that are said to have been possible only through government-financed research. Is there such a thing as a case for government spending on technology?
Is there a case for government spending on technology? I'm sure you could find a few advances. This is the same issue that comes up. Don't wars stimulate scientific and technological progress? It's basically the same issue as the lesson in Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. Look at what other alternatives have been lost if the government were not concentrating scientific and engineering talent on certain projects. Where would those people have been? They'd have been doing other things. And the effect of government getting control is actually to weaken scientific and technological research overall. It may have some effects in military research, some good effects in what the government is for, national defense. But as government has gotten more involved in science and technology have started to wither. And at the same time, we've developed anti-science and anti-technology. So I would say something very necessary to improve scientific and technological progress would be to abolish government involvement in any form of non-defense research. One more question. Okay, this gentleman right here.
Yeah. Given the imbalances in the economy today in terms of private and public debt and the ability of companies to earn, is it possible the economy to ease out of this problem without a severe dislocation?
Given the magnitude of private and public debts, is it possible for the economy to solve its problems without a severe dislocation? I think there will be some type of major problem. It's conceivable you could have a depression, but I think it's much more likely that the government will accelerate inflation again and enable people to pay their debts out of inflated dollars. I may be mistaken, but that is what I think is the more likely scenario. Again, I'm sorry to have to limit this. It's just our speaker must catch a train, and so we have to gear the schedule to that. Thank you very much.